You know, it's really something, isn't it? Just to think of the fact that a couple could be picked up by extraterrestrials, interrogated, probed, and whatever else they do, and then set down again. And for so many years, science just won't recognize the fact that something very bizarre happened to these two people who are no longer with us. Incredible story. Now, we'll be back in a moment. We'll take your phone calls with Stanton Friedman and Kathleen Martin on Coast to Coast AM. Kathleen, before we go to calls with you and Stanton, tell me about the section about extraordinary visual feats, the psi phenomena. And you talk about the plight of Natasha Demkina.
Yes, Natasha Demkina was a young Russian medical intuitive who claimed that she could see the full structure of the human body, including how internal organs are positioned and how they function. It was as if she almost had X-ray eyes. And this ability came upon her quite by accident after she'd had surgery for appendicitis. And one day she looked at her mother. And she didn't really understand at that time what she was observing. But over time, she came to realize that she could actually see diseased organs inside human beings. And she became very well known in Russia for this. And the news traveled internationally. And she had a great deal of success in some anecdotal type scientific studies, nothing with really good protocols set, although later on she did have success with that as well. But the Discovery Channel produced a television program in 2004, which was allegedly designed to test Natasha's paranormal ability in an objective and unbiased manner. She was told that she was going to be tested by some of the top scientists in the world. And so she was very excited about this to prove that she actually had this gift. Actually, there were three members of SICOP, now CSI, the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, who had designed this test for television. And it was designed in a way to increase her chance of failure. It was done differently from the normal protocols that Natasha followed. She was subjected to stress. She was suffering from jet lag. She was treated in a hostile way. She wasn't able to read the people in this experiment in the way that she normally does, and the team raised the bar for success. So even though she had very significant findings in this, she was deemed to have failed it because they had raised the bar on what was acceptable, not what was internationally acceptable, but what they determined would be okay with them as being acceptable. And we know that not all psychics are 100% successful. They have some good days and they have some bad days.
That's right.
And certain things such as sleep deprivation, the environment that they're in, and that sort of thing can reduce their chances of success.
Okay, let's
So
go ahead. I'm sorry.
okay. In the end, Nobel Prize-winning physicist and the director of the University of Cambridge's Mind-Matter Unification Project, Brian Josephson, ended up criticizing the experimental team's methodology and questioned their motives publicly, along with a number of other scientists. And an international well-known lawyer who went to bat for Natasha over this.
Okay, now we go to the phones. You ready? Here we go. We'll go to Doug, first-time caller in St. Louis. Go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I've been listening to your program forever. This is the first time I've ever called in. It's a
Great.
really great program.
Thanks, Doug.
I had a question for Mr. Friedman. I see from his website that he used to work on fission and fusion rockets, and that brings to mind somebody else that I heard of, Dr. Robert Bussard, who used to do the same thing. And I was wondering what Mr. Friedman thought of his work on that and the project that he was working on for the Navy right before he died on his inertial electrodynamic fusion project.
Well, there's a major difference here. We use the terms fission and fusion quite readily, but Bessar's rocket, the basic idea was, why carry along fuel when you can gather it along the way? Now, outer space is quite close to a perfect vacuum, but there is still hydrogen out there. And if you're going real fast and have a big collector in front of you, you can gather up some of this hydrogen and kick it out the back end with strong acceleration so that you add to the velocity of the rocket and keep going. And part of this is if you use hydrogen isotopes, then you can create fusion as opposed to fission. My work was in sort of in a different direction. When I was working on fission rockets for Westinghouse, we built and tested them on the ground. We in Los Alamos and Aerojet General. And well, the biggest one was operated by Los Alamos. Here we have a nuclear reactor that's less than 7 feet in diameter, putting out a power of 4,400 megawatts. That's twice the output of Grand Coulee Dam in something 7 feet in diameter. Quite remarkable. Tested not too far from Area 51. That was back in the 60s, and of course the program was canceled. Nuclear fusion, what I had looked at was in the early 60s at Aerojet General Nucleonics, with the man who had been in charge of the fusion work at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, John Luce. And what we found was that if you use the right stuff in the right way, deuterium and helium-3, that's heavy hydrogen that I mentioned in the cold fusion work, and helium-3, if you react those two isotopes, you can produce 10 million times as much energy per particle as you can get in a chemical rocket. And the stuff that you produce are charged particles, which are influenced by electric and magnetic fields, so you can kick them all out the back end of the rocket, and off you go into the universe. And that's very exciting work. And, of course, it can't be done cheaply. You know, you want to build one. If you got enough dough, you probably could, but who's got that kind of money? So Bussard was looking from a different direction, so to speak, than John Luce was, or the national, the fission reactor kind of stuff that they did at Westinghouse and Los Alamos. So good man, interesting idea. And again, the kicker here is progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. That laser is not just the better light bulb. Different physics.
Sure is. Okay, thanks for that. Let's go to Glenn in Harlington, Texas, east of the Rockies. Glenn, you're up with us. Go ahead.
Good morning, George. I have a question for Stanton.
Sure.
Stanton, did you work on the Convair NB36H test program?
I was working at General Electric and doing experiments down at Convair Fort Worth. And so these are radiation shielding experiments. We had a small reactor, actually quite similar to the one that was carried on the B-36. And I do want to correct a false impression that many people have had that that B-36 was powered by a nuclear reactor. It definitely was not. It's an immense airplane, incidentally, and a small reactor.
Yeah, I'm looking at a beautiful artist rendering of it right now.
Well, the thing is that the reactor, you know, there were plans and schemes and ideas and so forth, but there was a nuclear reactor operated on board a B-36 to produce radiation for shielding experiments. As you vary the altitude, you vary the density of the air, of course, and that affects the amount of radiation that gets scattered that leaves the reactor heading off not toward the pilot, but then gets scattered toward him. And so you need to, how do you do an experiment up in the air, you know, 5,000, 10,000, 20,000 feet? And so they did run a series of these runs out over the Gulf. Guys made good money because they would sleep on the way out and then do their experiments and sleep on the way back. But
My spec sheet says the crew capsule weighed 11 tons thanks to the lead and rubber lining and protective water shield.
Well, yeah, this wasn't a performance shield at all. It was to protect the crew of the plane from the reactor. But it had really nothing to do with the propulsion of the airplane. So the aircraft nuclear propulsion program carried on in mostly in the 50s, and especially between 1956 and 1960. I worked on that for 3 years at General Electric. And in 1958, we spent $100 million. That's what I was saying before. We employed 3,500 people. 1,100 of them were engineers and scientists. And we never operated a flying airplane on nuclear power. We learned a lot of interesting experiments, exciting program.
Are you disappointed that with our fascination with all things nuclear in the 50s, we didn't go ahead and
implement
build a proper space station and a proper space-faring, solar system-faring?
Yes, I am disappointed indeed. The fission rocket makes a good upper stage for a rocket if you want to go to Mars. Why is the space station using solar panels, these huge things, when a small reactor would do the job much better and weigh a lot less? There's been a lack of, how shall I put this, guts and courage. When it came time to fish or cut bait, we always cut bait. We needed more Admiral Rickovers, and we didn't have them in the rocket business as we did in the nuclear submarine business. We have a whole fleet of nuclear submarines and nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. And, you know, the startling statistic, a nuclear-powered carrier can operate for 18 years without refueling. That's a very impressive number. Yet, we didn't use it for most of the space program. We used radioisotope thermoelectric generators for the Pioneer spacecraft, Voyager, Viking, some of them. And the kicker is the Russians operated more than 35 reactors in space. We operated one. They had more power available for sideband radar and for particle beam weapons and all this kind of stuff. The failure to follow up on our leads in these things is really... It bothers me. It's a waste of opportunities we had. We should be leading, not following.
That's true. And Kathleen, when you were looking at all of the Betty Hill's memorabilia tapes and everything, was there anything that you came across that you found to be probably the most fascinating of the lot?
The information on the hypnosis tapes I found was fascinating because I had never had access to this. The information did not appear in the interrupted journey, and it really gave me a great deal of insight into Betty's and Barney's personalities, psychology, and history. So I found that to be very, very fascinating. In addition to that, letters to and from highly respected scientists who were very interested in what happened to Betty and Barney, and all of this was being done undercover by scientists who really didn't want their names to be associated with UFO abduction. And I found that there was a great deal of interest and support in this.
Quietly, though.
Those letters to be fascinating.
Did Betty ever explain to you what she truly felt, what she thinks happened to herself beyond under hypnosis?
I, at the end of Betty's life, interviewed her, and I did the type of interview, you know, several days over a period of time, where I wanted to take her step by step. Betty had, of course, over the years, developed a spiel on what happened to her, and she would go into what happened at a certain point. And I stopped her, and they said, no, I've heard all of that before. I don't want to hear that. listen to me. I want you to describe moment by moment what happened to you. And we went through that together, and I tape recorded that. It was very emotionally difficult for Betty to go back and to actually remember what she was going through at any moment.
I should mention here that one of the things that Kathleen found was a statement from Dr. Simon that the emotional intensity as Betty and Barty relived their experiences under hypnosis was every bit as great as that of any of the shell shock war veterans that he had treated. And he had to stop, what was it, one session each, I guess, because he couldn't, he didn't think they could handle the emotional intensity. We're not talking about casual experience here, in other words.
Okay, let's go to Angelina in Toronto, Canada. Go ahead, Angelina.
Hi, George.
Hi.
I'd like to make a comment about Betty and then ask Stantman a question. I believe they went through something real, but I believe it was all staged. I've had somebody in the government tell me that they're the actors. And yeah, and I believe that's what it was. And I wanted to ask Stanton if he ever heard that there was a flying saucer built in Malta, which is just outside the airport in Toronto in 1953.
Of course, the Avro car. As a matter of fact, there were two of them around. One of them is standing at the entrance to a museum down in the States and one in Canada. But it didn't fly like a saucer.
No, there's the plane and then there's the flying saucer. There were two different things.
Well, there were all kinds of planes at that facility. But the flying saucer was the Avro car, and there were supposed to be more of them later on. It didn't work very well. It didn't get more than a few feet off the ground. Yes, Avro built, matter of fact, one of the saddest comments about Canadian defense programs was that they clobbered the most advanced fighter in the world was cut up. The United States had protested. It's a long story. But that wasn't a flying saucer. It was that shape. But it certainly wasn't something that could duplicate the behavior of the saucers that Betty and Barney saw, these saucer, singular, and all the others that have been seen over the years all over the place. The ability to go very fast, very high, fly vertically, make right-angle turns, reverse, land in the middle of nowhere. Sorry, it doesn't cut it.
How would you, Stan, rate the Travis Walton case with the case of Barney and Betty Hill?
Well, it's interesting. They're both together in, I've been told in the same movie, UFOs Are Real, which I did way back in 79. I've spent time with Travis. I've been at his home, met his family. We've done television programs together. We met at places like Turkey and Brazil. I'm very much satisfied, especially after talking to Coral and Jim Lorenzen of APRO, that Travis was indeed abducted on board a craft, a very different experience from the Hill case. He was not an intentional abductee. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Zappo.
Absolutely. He's been on the program before, and I think the guy's authentic. We'll be back in a moment with final calls on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to have a floating format show on our next Coast to Coast show, including 2 hours with Dr. Andrew Wakefield. He is the doctor who is tying autism and vaccines together. So that'll be our next Coast to Coast show. Stan, would you say that the Barney and Betty Hill case, one of the best abduction cases out there?
No question. No question. Partly because Dr. Simon was unique in terms of the people who were investigating such cases. You know, he ran a hospital with 3,000 beds for veterans, yeah. PTSD now we'd say, but then it was shell shock. He knew what he was doing. He didn't know much about UFOs, but he sure knew how to help people who'd had a traumatic experience that they couldn't recall. And that's very important. He was an expert.
Okay, let's go to final calls. Wickenburg, Arizona, first of all. It's Robert, west of the Rockies. Hey, Robert, go ahead.
Hey, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Excuse me, Norrie, for taking my call. Your screener for letting me get through. I'd like to ask Mr. Friedman a question. This goes back to about April of 2008 when he was doing the promo the night of he presented his new book called Flying Saucers and Science. And Mr. Friedman, at the end of the hour, made a statement that I've never heard him mention since, and I'd like to ask him if he got any further information on it. He said, I think he said that the microwave energy has something to do with the operation of these flying saucers, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. What I was talking about was a process called magneto-aerodynamics, where you ionize the air, make it electrically conducting. That's what happens when a meteor comes into the atmosphere, that glowing stuff is ionized air, and you can use microwaves to do that. And if you have electric and magnetic field production capabilities, then you can control lift, drag, heating, sonic boom production, all the stuff that has to do with the performance of saucers, of anything in the air, as a matter of fact. And when I had a literature search done way back in about 1970, I guess, of industrial work, government reports, I had 900 responses to the keyword magneto-aerodynamics. 90% of these documents were classified. So there was a lot of work looking at this. And again, it's not cheap. It's not easy. You have to know what you're doing. It takes great care. But microwaves are one way. There are other ways, but it's a quick way of breaking down the air so that you can ionize, so you can interact with the electromagnetic fields. The electromagnetic submarine, using seawater as the electrically conducting fluid, that was built in the mid-60s, and it worked, and the Japanese built one, and it worked, small one. Hasn't been pursued for Lord knows why, but it's the same basic idea. Electric and magnetic fields at right angles produce a force at right angles to both. You push against the seawater, it pushes back. In the air, you ionize the air, you push against the ionized air, it pushes back. Newton's laws, which do work. And so it's a whole entirely different approach to flight. Not carrying along something you throw out the back end.
Kathleen, you know, we were just talking about Natasha and some of these feats. Discovery, I think back in 2004 or so, did a show on her. Anything new since then with her?
There were follow-up experiments in Japan. She's passed with flying colors. And she ended up going to what is sort of like a medical school in Russia and is, as far as I know, currently working as a medical intuitive in this Russian institute. So her ability is recognized as being legitimate in Russia.
There was a woman named Dr. Shafika Karagula.
That was my aunt.
You're kidding.
No, I'm serious.
Okay, well, she's written an exciting book about how she knew what was wrong with her patients when they came in. She ran the tests.
Breakthrough to creativity.
Yeah, right.
Yep.
That was your aunt.
Yes.
What a small world.
On my dad's side.
Okay.
It is.
And what I'm saying is that Natasha is not a trained medical person. Shafika was. And she, after the book came out, apparently she got loads of letters from other doctors who said they could do the same thing, but they sure weren't talking about it.
Exactly. She died strangely, Stanton. A radio fell in her tub.
You're kidding.
Wow. That's
wow.
Just a bizarre way to go.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. Kyle in Las Vegas, Nevada. Go ahead, Kyle.
Hi, guys. Hi, George.
Hey.
I was born in Roswell and raised in Arizona. I just wanted to thank Dr. Friedman for all that he's done to advance public awareness of the Roswell community and talk about what the Four Corners kids are bringing up these days about science.
Well, you're very welcome. It's not doctor, it's mister. I'll accept the honorary degree. And I will be in Roswell first week of July.
A couple weeks coming up.
Too. Yeah, coming up very soon. And we will each be giving lectures at the museum. There will be this press conference on July 2nd about a movie called Magic Men that somebody will play me and somebody will play Don Schmidt, and we'll talk about Roswell and MJ-12 and top secret magic and stuff like that. We don't have all the details yet, but I'm looking forward to that. And, you know, anybody who's coming to Roswell, be sure to carry some stuff to protect you against sunburn. It was 108 the other day there.
Oh, my gosh. Somebody wants Dreyfuss to play you, Richard Dreyfuss.
Oh, that's a good idea. I like that.
Well, that's not bad at all. All right, Kyle, thanks. Let's go to Dennis in St. Louis. You're up with us. Go ahead, Dennis.
Yes, good morning. When you were talking about where science got it wrong, during the development of the atomic bomb, one of the detractors to the bomb itself was the head of the Ordnance Department or something like that. He said he didn't believe the thing would work.
Oh, there were several people, and we talk about that in the book. Admiral Leahy, who was an expert on explosives.
Yeah, okay.
Truman's advisor on that sort of stuff. He said, you know, it was a damn fool thing. And he was an expert on explosives. Of course it wouldn't work. What are you going to say?
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's who I was trying to think of. Okay, thank you, Mr. Freeman.
You're very welcome.
There you go. Next up, we'll go to Larry, truck driving in Michigan, first-time caller. Larry, you are up.
How are you doing, George?
Okay.
I just wanted to say thank you for taking Coast to a whole new level. You and your staff have done a fantastic job. And in my opinion, the two people who have brought the whole UFO experiences to the forefront has been Eric Von Daniken, of course, and Mr. Stan Freeman. And I just wanted to say thank you to Stan for having the courage to do the research and bring it out to the public and stand by his word and let everybody know the truth. And that's all I wanted to say. Just thank you.
You're very welcome.
There you go. Texted from Kenny in St. Louis wants to know, either one of you can answer this, do you believe God and aliens to be one and the same?
Oh, boy. Flip a coin. I don't think they're the same. I like the Pope's comment. If he made us, he could have made aliens, too. So we're all part of brethren in space.
Yeah.
I'll stop there and without getting into the religious argument.
How about
aliens or gods?
I agree with Stan on that. I think that aliens are more comparable to humans, although they're very different from us in a sense. But I do like the Pope's statement that if God created life on Earth, why not elsewhere in the universe as well?
Did Betty ever question what they wanted with her and her husband?
She seemed to know that what they wanted to do, and Barney was of the same opinion, was to determine the differences between human beings and themselves. They were very interested in Betty and Barney's skeletal structures, for example. Our joints, our bone structure, is very different from the ETs that Betty and Barney encountered. Our mouths, for example, are very different. These ETs did not have teeth. There was a membrane inside the mouth that fluttered when they spoke among themselves in sort of a humming or buzzing kind of language that Betty and Barney understood telepathically. So they were really interested in the differences between themselves and human beings.
Okay, we go to Rochester, New Hampshire. Alex is with us. Go ahead, Alex.
Yes, I want to thank everyone, George and Stanton and Kathleen, for doing the show. I really appreciate it. I met you, Kathleen, in Farmington, New Hampshire, when you gave a presentation about your book, Captured. Also, I believe Stan Friedman wrote the introduction, I believe. Anyhow, I met you at the library, and later spoke with you on the phone about a UFO sighting. But the reason I'm calling is there is an art exhibit in Rochester, New Hampshire. It's a temporary public art exhibition where there's 20 different sites that people can walk to downtown. And one of them includes, it's titled Happened, and it's about the Betty and Barney Hill story. I thought you might be interested. Yeah. And there's there's two aspects to each site, and this particular site, which covers the story, has kind of like a painting as well as a poem. And the painting, I believe, does justice to the story, giving it credibility. I myself believe what happened to Betty and Barney Hill. But the poem itself, it does sort of cast this sort of idea that it was sort of a delusion or a projection on Betty and Barney Hill's part. I'll just recite a brief part of the poem that says, "The godly see angels, the alienated The godly sea angels, the alienated sea aliens. How reassuring to know their ships will open to receive. Their proddings will ward off the loneliness of being an interracial couple in the 60s. Not, that's just a part of the poem, but you get the idea that it kind of doubts the veracity yeah. of their story. And I myself, you know, I was born in New Hampshire, grew up in New Hampshire. I'm familiar with the White Mountains area. I never met Betty or Barney Hill, but the idea, the belief, the fact that they were an interracial couple in the 60s in New Hampshire, which is predominantly white, I think, in my opinion, adds credibility to their story, because it's my understanding that Barney Hill was a member of the NAACP, and it's my understanding from the readings I've done that he was very reluctant to come forward because he didn't want to do damage to that cause. And the fact that he did eventually come forward with the story, I think, speaks to his credibility and to the credibility of the story in general.
That's a good point, Alex. Very good. What do you think? Kathleen, let's start with you on that.
Well, that's very true. Betty and Barney, first of all, were not alienated. They were very proactive and very involved in the civil rights movement. In fact, Barney was appointed by the governor of New Hampshire to serve on the committee, State Advisory Committee to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. He was well known throughout the state. And Betty and Barney did not have an interest in UFOs or aliens before they had this experience in the White Mountains. So whoever wrote the poem was not familiar with the characteristics of Betty and Barney. The exhibit sounds interesting, though. And I'm living in Florida, but I'm going to be in New Hampshire in August. I'll be there in September for the second Exeter, New Hampshire UFO Festival, which will take place over Labor Day weekend. Stan, in fact, is going to be speaking there. I'll just be attending and autographing books and that sort of thing. But it would be interesting if it's still in Rochester to go up and visit the exhibit.
Kathleen, do you make these tapes of Betty and Barney Hill available?
I make them available to scientists and to mental health professionals who want to come to my house to listen to them. I have written directives from Betty as the executor of her estate, the trustee of her estate, that she did not want them distributed to the public. This is personal medical information. It's confidential. But I do make it available to people who normally do have access to that type of information.
Would we...
For training purposes.
Would we be disrespecting what she wanted if we played a few minutes of it one night? Maybe you could make it available?
There are excerpts that I have made available. It doesn't include the information,
the personal stuff, right.
The sexual information, that sort of thing.
Okay. Yeah, maybe we can do that. We'll have our producers call you back and have you and Stan come back and maybe just play a few minutes of one.
Sounds great.
Okay, we'll do that.
I do play the tapes. Excerpts from the tapes when I lecture on the Betty and Barney Hill UFO incident, which I will be doing in Roswell in July, and also I won't be doing it at the MUFON International Symposium. I'll be speaking on the conundrum of alien abduction there.
Stan, in just a few minutes we have, we'll take final calls, but where do we get the book Science Was Wrong and also Captured?
Well, both, of course, through the Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com and all that stuff. Or from the one advantage of getting them from myself or from Kathleen is you get books autographed by both of us. We use book plates. We don't send the books back and forth. And from my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, or you can send a check. You can go there, and you can send a check to Post Office Box 958, Holton, beautiful downtown Holton, Maine, 04730-0958, including priority mail postage. It's 1995, and Kathleen has it available, too. Why don't you give your information, Kathleen?
Yes, it is on my website at www.kathleen-marden.com. It's available, both books sent priority mail, the same as Stan's. And you can use a credit card to purchase it from my site, or you can send a check or money order to me. And it is at P.O. Box 120172, Claremont, C-L-E-R-M-O-N-T, Florida, 34712. Captured is 1899, and Science Was Wrong is 1999.
I've got visions of Stan, of you walking through Holton, Maine with a bag full of checks back into Canada from all your book sales.
Got to stop at the border now.
You never know.
It's a lot easier to do it from Maine than it is to cross the border with the books and stuff, and the mail service a lot better.
Stan, we got a minute left. Are we going to get disclosure at all in this country?
Well, I'm waiting for that book. I think we will, but I think it's not going to come right away. There are serious problems with how you do this, and you don't want to upset the world. It's already in an upset point, and it's got to be handled properly. We don't have much experience at bringing something like this. So, I won't say catastrophic, but so with so much impact on all areas of our society, we don't know how to do that very well. So I'm trying to educate people so they'll be ready. Somebody asked me why I'm still alive. How come you haven't been shot for talking about Cosmic Watergate? I said, maybe I'm doing what they want done, and get more and more people aware that there's something going on. So when disclosure does come, we're more ready for it.
Absolutely. Stan, thank you so much. Kathleen as well. Both of them miraculous people, aren't they? For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.